WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Later, they realized what I knew about pop music and recording people, and I became the most prolific producer they had. But you add a touch of yourself to it. You must.
You've done a number of takes for some of the records that you've produced. When the musicians got done playing a tune, if you didn't think it was quite right, if you thought that they could really do it better, how many times would you let yourself do that and ask them to do it again before, or did you always wait till you felt, oh, that's it, that is a take?
You always try to get it on the first take, because that's always the best, or the second even maybe better than the first. But first you run the tune down. We had to do that in those days because you cut on wax or acetate, and you were limited as to playing time. The average 10-inch record ran 2:50 to 3 minutes and 15 or 20 seconds, and that's why I did the first long Commodore jazz concert. Jam session number 3 was Four Sides of a Good Man is Hard to Find on 12-inch. I wanted to get a long performance like they would do in a nightclub, but it's one of our famous recordings, but there was no tape, and I had to stop each time and start again on this part two. Anyway, you're limited by the amount of playing time, so you run it down, time a chorus, say it runs 40 seconds. You say, well, we'll get 40, we'll get three choruses on it. Then you say, first chorus, you play the tune, second chorus, you give it to Pee-wee, then to Bobby, then to Jess Stacy, then you go back to the ensemble or a half a chorus. You have to time it to fit on the record. Some good takes are lost because it runs too long. But you run it down, and when you use musicians like we used on Commodore, they're all such pros, you know. It's like a great football team or a great basketball team. They know what they're all doing, and if we picked out the songs, Eddie and I, they would play them in the room so they'd get real familiar with them. And when they came to the session on Saturday, they would be ready. You'd only need one or two takes.
What would you have for the musicians? What kind of environment did you try to, create for them?
Well, I knew most of them liked to drink, so I would have a couple of bottles on a date, but I wouldn't open them until we had two numbers done. And because, you know, you'd want them to get the four songs in.
We're going to hear another record that you produced for Commodore. Let me ask you to tell us a little bit about the session, what your recollections of the session with Hawkins.
Oh, this was when Hawkins came back from France, and he had been away from the U.S. for a number of years. And Leonard Feather came, he's another fellow who's coming to the store. Leonard Feather came into the store, and he said, Milt, do you know Hawkins? I said, I never met him. I know all about him, of course, but I had never met him. He said, well, he's back from France, and he's opening on 52nd Street. And he had just made Body and Soul for Bluebird. And I said, sure, I want him. So Feather said, well, I'll get him. I know him. And he picked the tunes out. I picked I Surrender Dear because he could do a ballad treatment of it. And I used Roy for the trumpet relief on it, same as I had used Roy and Chew Berry on Body and Soul. And we did I Surrender. Benny Carter was on the session also, but he doesn't play on this because it was strictly Coleman Hawkins and Roy Eldridge.
Okay, let's hear it. This is I Surrender Dear. Mm-hmm. Coleman Hawkins and Roy Eldridge. By the way, the piano that you heard, that was Benny Carter. Milt Gabler was saying as we were listening to it that Benny Carter, who's known mostly for his alto playing and trumpet playing, also played piano, and that was him featured on this session. My guest is Milt Gabler. We're talking about his Commodore record label and the Commodore record shop that he ran up till about 1958 in Manhattan. You've been in jazz for a long time and have seen many different styles come and go and many different fads and fashions in jazz become marketable and suddenly unmarketable. You have been a promoter of jazz recordings. You've worked for a big company and for your own independent small Commodore label. What do you think now about the amount of muscle that record companies are putting into jazz?
Well, some of them seem to be putting a lot of muscle into it. I don't know if the records are selling as much as the excitement created in the press about jazz coming back and all, and whether it will pay off dollar-wise for the major companies. It seems that independent companies with a low overhead can handle jazz better than the big companies because if they don't get a large enough sale, they tend to get off of it fast, the same as they would a pop record, and first thing you know, they're frowning at the jazz artist, and the jazz artist gets unhappy, and it hasn't changed much in all of the years. There is a larger market, more young people are getting into it, and with the rock and fusion jazz, I don't personally like it as much as the mainstream and traditional and some of the contemporary artists. But because to me it's a hybrid, really. It's a way to try and get jazz people to sell more by putting rock behind them, you know. And to me, I just like that beautiful, tight rhythm, you know.
Now, a lot of people think that if the record companies just paid a little more attention to the jazz musicians and put a little more push and a little bit more advertising money into their work, that jazz would sell a lot more, would reach a wider audience, and would kind of gain popularity, since there's this incredible syndrome, you know, in music, like what's played on the radio is what's sold is what's played, well, and it's this huge self-perpetuating cycle,
right.
But you've got to put that kind of, the way the record industry is now, you've got to put that money and muscle in somewhere to start that cycle going.
But the computer adds it all up after a period of time, and they say if we spend $50,000 promoting an artist and it doesn't come back, we might be better off spending $50,000 on, a rock group or a contemporary group, because if they hit, the proceeds and the income is 10 times greater. No matter how much you make jazz records sell, it's a fellow like George Benson can make a hit record because he sings with it also, and it's really like a pop, like when Billy made pops, and some of the stuff Billy Joel sings are like pop, Billie Holiday derivative, but that's not jazz. Jazz has got almost a set audience. I think if you can sell 75 or 100,000, which is piddling in comparison to the figures you get on a contemporary group, and you keep your budget down based on the possibility of selling 50,000 records, the jazz records cost much less to make.
Oh, yeah.
You see.
Well, the rock records, you can spend 6 months in the studios producing one.
Yeah, right.
They
cost much less to make. Therefore, you can keep it under control and do promote it and advertise it. Just don't let it sit on a shelf all by itself or have the artist peddle it in clubs and you can probably double the sale of the jazz records, but it'll never be like a popular record.
You think so? Because in Europe, it seems to be...
It's the same over there.
Really
I've been to Europe.
Uh-huh.
They work. What's good about it is the jazz people can work more. But they... You go over and listen to... I go over to record Bert Kempfert in West Germany, and he's got a lot of great jazzmen in that band, and he's a great arranger. And... Even so, when these people make there are a lot of American musicians over there, and good British musicians, and Dutch musicians, and all. And they make jazz recordings. And the big thing is when the Americans go on tour over there, they can be 70 years old. They'll do business, mm-hmm. and because they want to see them. And they always were more appreciative about jazz there. You'll find old clubs still in business there. But here, I know New York City has a lot of jazz people working now, which is very encouraging. But you're not going to talk about big numbers, and that's what the major companies are interested in. So they will budget their jazz promotions. You could get killed taking full-page ads on record. It doesn't mean anything if you can't get it on the air, excepting on your beautiful program called Fresh Air.
Thank you. Let's listen to another one of the sessions, another one of the Commodore sessions. This is from one of my favorites. This is Lester Young and the Kansas City Six.
Can I tell you
about
this?
Tell us what led to this session.
Our friend John Hammond had become a producer, a recording man for Vocalion. Brunswick. Well, he was doing Teddy and all, he came into me one day, just like Billy came in. He had done a recording with what I call the Kansas City Five, with Buck Clayton and the rhythm from the Basie Orchestra, and who was the trombonist arranger? I'll have to look it up after the record. I'll tell you who it was. He cooked the little thing up, the backgrounds. First jazz electric guitarist, not Charlie Christian, the first, was the guy that put this together. And John came in and he said, they won't release it. They won't issue it. Would you pay them for the session and you put it out? So I know everything John did had to be done with taste and be good. And he said there were three sides. And I said, I'll take them without hearing them, John. Tell the company I'll buy the records. I said, but I can't use three sides. I have to have a coupling. But I tell you what I want to do. I want to add Lester Young on clarinet to the session because I love the way he played clarinet on the Basie recording of Blue and Sentimental. And with the light sound of this, that's what you call being a producer, right? The light, even though I didn't know what I was doing, the light sound of that group couldn't take the heavy tenor, and Lester played light when he played tenor, but mostly I wanted to have him on clarinet. And this was my favorite side from that session. He played such beautiful clarinet on it. And it's called I Want a Little Girl, which was a Kansas City tune that Jimmy Rushin used to sing a lot. And let's play that.
Thank you.
Lester Young on clarinet, the Kansas City Six, recording of I Want a Little Girl. And the person Milt Gabler was referring to as the guitarist was Eddie Durham on that, who was featured on amplified guitar. How did it come to be that all these sidemen in the Basie band and the Basie's rhythm section were playing with Lester Young and Basie wasn't around?
Well, he was a Decca artist. You see, the band leader has an exclusive contract, and you can't record the leader of the band. In fact, I call one of the blues on this Countless Blues, but it didn't have piano on it at all. It was a great session. It got great critical acclaim because it was like a Ceylon group. It was quiet, like a string quartet, and it's nice to listen to even to this day. And
oh, they're beautiful recordings. What was it like working with Lester Young?
Well, he was a gentle person. Never spoke much. He just played from the heart. I call him poetic. To me, on this record, when he plays pretty like this, and Pee Wee Russell plays pretty like this, there's a lot of similarity, and I'm the only one that ever says that. But I remember at Jimmy Ryan's on Sundays, when I'd have Pee Wee and Lester Young playing there, Lester Young on tenor, of course, that when he got off the stand, he would stand next to the drummer, because Pee Wee was playing in the front line, and he loved Pee Wee Russell. And when he plays lower register and Pee-wee plays a pretty thing lower register, a lot of similarity. They both were poets of their, on their instruments. And Pee-wee didn't really come into his own until years later when he started to play with musicians other than the Condon Gang. And he was really a sensational player, too.
Lester Young, apparently.
But Lester was a delight.
Yeah. What was it like to talk with him? From what I understand, I mean, his speech patterns were... he just had a really kind of very private, eccentric
language.
I had
no one tell a story. I was doing a session with him once, and he said, let's go back to George Washington. And I didn't realize that, you know, you make a slow take because he had his own way of talking, and... He meant the bridge, the channel of the song. Let's go back to the bridge. And his mind was that way, and it was so funny. The guys all broke up.
That's great. Let's listen to another one of the sessions that you've brought with you today. And we're going to hear something with Wild Bill Davison. Want to tell us about the session?
Well, this is one of my favorite Commodore sessions, and I think one of the greatest Dixieland-style jazz records ever made. It was the first thing we did after that 1943 recording ban when Wild Bill had come to New York. He had been working around town, playing in the Village, playing at Jimmy Ryan's, and got back in with his old friends from Chicago. And this is almost the perfect jazz band, and it happened to come out that way in the recording. And talking about direct-to-disc recording, listen to this session, which was made with one main mic and a mic to open near the piano player in 1943. And the first tune we made after the recording band with Wild Bill Davison. And I love the band so much I call it the Commodores. And it has, I might as well give the personnel, it has Wild Bill, Pee Wee Russell, George Brunis, that great tailgate trombonist, Gene Schroeder on piano, Bob Casey on bass, Eddie Condon guitar, and George Wetling, who was the favorite drummer of mine on all this type of Commodore recording. That's a plenty. Listen to it.
That's a plenty from another Commodore session. My guest, if you're just joining us, is Milt Gabler, who ran the now legendary Commodore Record Shop in Manhattan, and from 1938 to about 1948, produced for his own independent record company, Commodore Records. Let's move on to another tune. I want to be able to get to hear more. This is something with Mel Powell and Benny Goodman. You want to tell us about this session?
This was made in the early 40s when Mel Powell came into the store. Mel Powell kind of grew up at the Commodore, and he used to come in, and he was taking piano lessons at that time. He started when he was a young student to study classical music, but then he got interested in jazz, and he was taking lessons from Willie the Lion Smith, who was hanging around the store a lot at that time also. And one day Irving Kerlouden came in, and Jess Stacy was leaving the Goodman Band, and he said, "Who can I get on piano?" And I said, "I got a kid that comes in here that will just be fantastic. He knows every note Jess ever played, and he's a very competent young musician." And he said, "Who?" I said, "His name is Mel Powell." And he went over and he auditioned and he got the gig right away. And he was working with Benny and starting to do arranging for him. He did quite a few important arrangements for the Goodman Band. And he was cooking up a Commodore session for me to be done with members of the Goodman Orchestra. And they were running down The World is Waiting for the Sunrise during a five-minute break or so on a Goodman rehearsal time. And Benny heard the arrangement, and he came over and he started to play with them, to sit in and play with in Mel's arrangement, and he loved it. And he says, "What is this for?" Mel says, "For Milt at the Commodore." And Benny said, "I want to play it. I want to play on the record." And he was a Columbia artist. So I didn't dare do. Benny was such a big name. I didn't dare say, go ask Columbia for permission. I figured if Benny would take a chance to record for me, I'd go ahead and do the date. And sure enough, the day of the session came, and Benny came into the studio. I recorded this in Studio B at Decca, I remember. And he showed up, and I was tickled. Well, I had known Benny since he used to come into the Commodore and do studio work and pit band work. And he used to buy sporting goods from me and stuff like that. And we had a great rapport. And sure enough, he showed up for the date. And on the label, I was afraid that I couldn't say Benny Goodman Clarinet. I called him Shoeless John Jackson on the original Commodore label. And that became a very famous record because everyone knew who Shoeless John Jackson was the minute you heard the first bar of the clarinet. So let's play this. It's one of the great Commodore records, which I hope one day will wind up in the Record Academy Hall of Fame. Thank you.
the world is waiting for the sunrise. And we heard Mel Powell at the piano, Benny Goodman clarinet, another of the Commodore sessions. One of the reissue recordings that Milt Gabler did with Commodore was a reissued work of Jelly Roll Morton in the, late 1930s? Did you?
He made it in 1939. It was similar to the Library of Congress recordings he did. He did them for General Records. And one day, Hazard Reeves, who owned General Records, called me up, and he wanted to sell the company, and I grabbed it because of this album, and I bought all the 78s.
Did you get to meet Jelly Roll Morton?
Well, he used to come into the store at the years when he came up to make the General recordings, and he was just like you read about him. He gave me one of his cards, the inventor of jazz, stomps, and swing, and he was a colorful individual. I think he had one tooth with a diamond in it, and he was very nice to talk to and all.
Were the latter years of his life difficult monetarily, you know,
did it? I don't know. He always dressed nicely. He always looked the same, you know, thin, and he didn't stay to chat too long, you know. And he just came in because it was a place for musicians to drop in and let me know they were in town, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I used to get mail for musicians. I used to lend them money out of the till. We have a song called Tapping the Commodore Till. Some days I loaned out more money than I took in, and especially in the 52nd Street store. But we had our mail order business, so it was okay.
We're going to hear one of these Jelly Roll Morton sessions.
Good.
We'll hear Buddy Bolden's Blues. Do you want to say a few words about it before we get to it?
There's nothing much you can say, but it's just a delightful record with a Jelly's own inimitable way of singing, and nobody could top him at this kind of thing. It's just piano and voice, and it holds you.
Thought I heard Buddy Bolden say, "You're nasty, you're dirty. Take it away. You're terrible, you're awful. Take it away." I thought I heard him say. I thought I heard Buddy Bolden shout. Open up that window and let that bad air out. Open up that window. Let the foul air out. I thought I heard Buddy Bolden say. Thought I heard Judge Fogarty say, 30 days in the market. Take him away. Get him a good broom to sweep with. Take him away. I thought I heard him say. Thought I heard Frankie Dewson shout, "Gal, give me that money. I'm gonna beat it out. I mean, give me that money like I explain you. I'm gonna beat it out," 'cause I thought I heard Frankie Dewson say. Thank you.
Jelly Roll Morton singing, and at the piano, Buddy Bolden's Blues, one of the sessions on the Commodore record label. We're going to get to hear a little bit of Jack Teagarden next. This is great. I really love to hear Teagarden sing. You got a chance to work with him when you produced the session that we're about to hear. Did you get a sense of what he thought of his own singing? I mean, for me, when I'm looking at a Teagarden record, I'm going to see how many times he sings on it. I mean, really. Well, which isn't to say I don't love his trombone playing.
Well, everybody loves his singing. It's a singing musician, and I always favor them, even if they don't have a lyric voice, you know. They get more flavor into it, and they play it like they play the horn. They sing it like they play the horn. And Teagarden was always a joy to work with, and he got so much respect from all the other men, and he was the king of what he did. And Tommy Dorsey was different, and Jack Jenny was different, but Teagarden was a first and a one of a kind, and a lot of guys imitated him, but there was only one Teagarden, and when he sang, you loved it. And the thing we're going to play, we made in 1944, and it has Maxie Kaminsky on it, who always gives you that good, solid trumpet. And it's from an album of Jack Teagarden and Max Kaminsky. And I think Ernie Caceres played clarinet on this record. He played beautiful clarinet. People generally know him as a baritone sax player. From his big band work. And Norma Teagarden plays piano. It's one of the few recordings she made. And during the session, Wingy Minone dropped in to say hello while we were recording. So we had made one take, which I haven't issued yet, of Teagarden singing Rockin' Chair alone. The tune we're going to hear is Rockin' Chair. But Wingy walked in the studio, and we had him sing the fills that you always hear on Rockin' Chair, like when Louie and Trauma Young did it. And so let's play this Rockin' Chair, one of my favorites.
Rockin' chair got you, Jackson.
In by my side.
In by your side.
Fetch me my gin, son.
I ain't got no gin, father.
For I tend your hide.
Gonna tend my hide, boy.
Can't get from this cabin.
Can't get from this cabin.
Ain't going nowhere.
You ain't going nowhere, oh.
Just sitting here grabbing at the flies around this rocking chair.
Rocking chair, ooh.
My dear old Aunt Harriet.
My Aunt Harriet too, boy.
How long in heaven she be?
Ain't gonna be long.
Send me a sweet chariot.
And you got it.
For the end of the trouble I see.
I see, Jackson.
Oh, rock and check it.
Oh, rock, check, get it.
Judgment Day is here.
Judgment Day is here, baby.
I'm chained to my old rocking chair.
Rocking chair.
Okay, we just heard Jack Teagarden, recording of Rockin' Chair. If you're just joining us, my guest is Milt Gabler, the man behind the Commodore Record Shop and Commodore Records. He is the producer of the session that we just heard, as well as many other sessions with many other musicians. It's been 30 or 40 years since you recorded many of the things. How have they changed for you over time?
You mean the sound and
the
feeling?
The sound of it and the feeling of it, yeah.
You hear them, they're just as exciting to me, and of course I get a little catch and feel sad when I think that a lot of these fellows are gone and I'm still here, but by the same token, I still have the permanent record of the work they did in the 40s and the end of the 30s, and the idea was to catch them when they were at their peak and record the songs, because a lot of these tunes you don't hear on the air or in rooms, and especially the old-time traditional tunes. And that's why I made them in the 40s, to preserve them, because when the swing era came in, which I always felt the Commodore was kind of responsible for, we had the writers point up that word. It was really the same old jazz, but we called it swing music. That band swung. Man, that swings. So we call it swing music. But it's really mainstream, traditional, whatever you want to call it. If it's good, it's a delight to hear for the rest of your life. And the spirit on these records, the difference in the Commodores and other records contemporary at that time, recorded at that time, is the Commodores had a lot of life to them. We were able to make inspirational recordings because all the musicians loved each other and they were getting together from different bands, and it wasn't the same old thing every night. It was Teagarden sitting in with Condon or Freeman coming out of Tommy's band, and these boys had known themselves for many years and went way back, 10 years earlier they had played together. And it was exciting for them to get together and support each other and thrill each other all over again. And I would sit there in the booth, and if I didn't like it, I'd say, take another one, it can be better. And then when they had, I'd say, that's it. Sometimes we get it on one take, sometimes on three, sometimes on two. Luckily, I was able to have two takes on a lot of things, because today you record on tape, and when you get it, generally the other performances are wiped out. Or in some studios I've worked, they roll back in order not to waste tape, and that kills me.
Oh.
That's their policy.
Yeah.
But I saved at least two cuts of everything I made.
Well, Mick Gabler, we really have you to thank for having these records now, for being able to listen to Lester Young and the Kansas City Six and Chu Berry recordings and Coleman Hawkins recordings. Thank you so much for all you've done for jazz, and thank you very much for being here this afternoon on Fresh Air. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your coming down and joining us today and sharing so much with us.
Terry, I appreciate it, and there's nothing I love more than talking about my life's work or my life, music.